Blog Talk Radio.
Jeremy Piven discusses his new film, The Goods, Live Hard, Sell Hard, and the possibility of an Entourage movie. And we continue our Inside the Classic series with an examination of Bernardo Bertolucci's 1973 masterpiece, Last Tango in Paris, with critic Doug Pratt and Marlon Brando biographer Stefan Kanfer. Coming up next on Movie Geeks United. Welcome to the show, everybody. This is Movie Geeks United. My name is Jamie.
And my name is Jerry. Welcome to our show. We got a blast for you tonight.
Yeah, it's a good one. These past few have been very good for us, and some exciting material here tonight if you're a movie geek like we are, obviously.
Yeah, so yeah, we got all the good stuff here for tonight and next week. We just got lots of explosive, awesome stuff for you.
Yeah, the movie season seems to be picking up, and there's some movies that I'm anxious to see finally after, it seems like an almost full month that I haven't been driven to go to the movie theater and check out many of these.
Yeah, I know, and it is that kind of thing, but we got District 9, The Goods, and then next week Inglourious Basterds, and then the following week Taking Woodstock, and then September, it's all coming. I think what is going to happen, it's like 2006, where the summer was, half-baked at best, and once you get to the end of the summer and the fall, it really goes into high gear.
Yeah. I think so too, and we said at the beginning of the year that this is the year of the great director. We were looking at the slate of movies throughout the year, and we said all of our favorite directors, all the legends that are still working, they have movies out this year. Coppola, Scorsese,
Michael Mann, you got Scorsese, and you got the big one, Cameron. You got Tarantino next week.
Exactly,
I mean, it's just. It's big.
It's a good year for movie geeks, I think.
It's
so.
A very good year for movie geeks. There have been some high-profile disappointments, though, with that, but that's to be expected. It's just where it wasn't. They weren't the ones that I was expecting to be disappointments, though.
Yeah.
But,
meanwhile, movies like District 9 have been getting good reviews and glorious.
Except for Armand White called Peter Jackson a racist. I saw that earlier.
Really? Well.
Yeah. And that should surprise no one.
Yeah. And then some upcoming great movies. And we're going to talk about a great movie coming out this Friday.
Yeah.
With Mr. Piven. You want to get to it?
Let's do it. Let's bring it on.
All right. Jeremy Piven. I mean, we're crazy about this actor. He's terrific in everything he does. And he's been around for a while. He's been acting since the age of 8. He started in the theater.
Mm-hmm.
And he's done 40 movies, something around 40 movies, movies like The Runaway Jury and Gross Point Blank and The Kingdom and Smokin' Aces and
Old School.
On and on and on. Old School, yes.
And he was in Rock and Roll at the end of last year. I mean, he really has been all over the place. And, I feel like, both of us, I think all of us have grown up with him since, like, high school on.
Yeah.
We've grown up with Jeremy, so it's nice to see him, getting all these juicy roles the last couple of years.
Yeah, it's coming his way now. He's really hit a stride, and I think it started as the kind of hold no prisoners Uber agent Ari Gold in the TV series Entourage.
Mm-hmm.
And now he's got the starring role in a feature film, a comedy, from the guys that brought you Talladega Nights and Step Brothers. I mean, that's an unbeatable chemistry there.
Yeah, you really can't do much better than that. I mean, that's pretty good.
The movie opens up this Friday, and it's called The Goods, Live Hard, Sell Hard. And we spoke to Jeremy about this film and about many other points of interest in his career. Here is Jeremy Piven.
Sir, there's no smoking on airplanes.
I know.
It's ridiculous, isn't it?
If you like, then I'll have to report you to the FAA.
Stacy, did you know that in 1969, when smoking was allowed on all flights, we put a man on the moon?
I had no idea.
And it starts with ashtrays, and it ends with all of our precious freedoms being stripped away. But we don't have to take it. Like Rosa Parks and David Lee Roth when he left Van Halen, we can say enough injustice. We can smoke one for America!
Who are you?
I'm done ready. I got the goods. You want some cars sold? Well, there. We got a dealership in the ICU. 211 cars getting suntans on the lot.
Don, I don't mean to complain, but it's been a year and a half since I've been home. And I'm 90% sure I left my front door open.
July 4th weekend, everybody, and we're going to war. Don't even get me started on Pearl Harbor. We are the Americans, and they are the enemy. Never again!
Never again! Never again!
Let's get him!
Alligators! Who brought alligators?
Don Reddy sure does put on a show.
These people are excited about the savings.
The goods. Live hard. Sell hard.
I wanted to ask you, because I remember seeing a documentary that I was crazy about a couple of years ago. It was John Landis's Slasher. And I'm wondering if that was a point of reference for you.
Well, it was for me, and I don't know if it was for any of the filmmakers or anyone involved initially, but just to do research, like, there is a group of guys out there, and they spend their lives on the road. And they're called slashers, and they slash prices and move cars. When you can no longer sell your cars, you call these guys in, and they do their job. And that's basically what my job was in this movie. So it was great research.
Well, what kind of characteristics do these guys have, did you find?
I just found that they were just kind of relentless and always trying to figure out new ways to sell cars. And, I mean, God, man, what a life. They have these families, and they leave them at home, and they never make it home. And they get on the mic, and they have to, as they say, sell the metal, sell the cars, and find new creative ways to do it every day. I mean, it's, wow, what a tough way to make a living. And they also, just like the movie says, live hard, sell hard. They live really hard, and they sell hard.
Yeah, and I would think particularly challenging in this economy, too.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a great broad comedy, but it's prescient too with this, with the way things are today with the car industry.
Yeah, I think it's also a really funny way to take a look at what's going on, and I think we need to do that.
Yeah,
I mean that it's just, we need to have that release right now. The I've actually run into a bunch of car salesmen and seen the movie, and they just love it.
That's great.
Speaking of that, I'll just point of references. I was just curious, did you go back at all and look at the old Kurt Russell movie Used Cars?
I never did see that movie.
Oh, okay. Because that's the first thing, like, a couple of us when we saw the trailer, I was like, oh, my God, they're making a new, like, you know, an updated version of Used Cars in one sense. And that's, like, one of those, like, great iconic movies of the inflation recession of the late 70s.
Right.
Yeah.
You know what? I unfortunately did not get a chance to look at that.
That's all right. That's okay.
Now, did you try to sell cars on your own to prepare for this?
No, I did not try to sell cars, but I was on the receiving end quite a bit and got to study it. I did think about going undercover and trying to sell some cars, but I really feel like just being in that world and feeling it, being on the receiving end, was enough for me to kind of take that leap of faith with the character himself and just kind of play it as convincingly as possible. And first and foremost, this movie is funny. It's just an entertaining movie. That's really what it is.
Yeah. And you go, I know you go toe-to-toe with some really brilliant comic actors. I mean, I think you're a brilliant comic actor, too. But tell me about that. Tell me about going toe-to-toe with somebody like Will Ferrell, for instance.
Well, both Will and Ed Helms and Dr. Ken and Craig Robinson, this entire cast, they all have a really rare combination of things. They just happen to be genuinely funny. Their timing is kind of amazing, and they're also all real improvisers, natural-born improvisers, and people that have been improvising most of their lives. So you get this, like, almost triple threat from these guys where they can pull off the performance, it's genuinely funny, and then they can just add to all the language. And that's just gold when it comes to a comedy.
I'm wondering for you though, when you read the script, what your initial impressions were, what excited you about it?
Well, I just wonder what was wrong with these people. I think they needed some help and they're mentally ill. The script was just so funny, so unapologetic. It wasn't PC, and they just were really on to something. And you're reading a comedy, you're either going to laugh or you don't. And I haven't laughed this hard since I read Old School. And that's the last time I worked with Will as well.
I know that you're crazy about this movie. You've been talking about how impressed you were with it. When you finally saw it, sat down and saw it, did anything about it surprise you?
I was surprised at how it was so funny that you had to trim it because the laughs would go well into the next scene. So it was kind of an embarrassment of riches almost. Actually, Catherine Hahn really surprised me. Not that I didn't think she was great while we were shooting, but I had no idea just how great. She is a complete revelation.
Well, this is a great project for you, I know, because you've been in the business for a long time. You've been acting since, I think, you were 8.
Yeah.
So now you've hit your stride, it seems, with Entourage and now the starring role in this film. The journey it took to get to this place, what is the benefit of that journey as opposed to being, you know, a so-called overnight success for you?
Wow, that's a long night, isn't it? If it's overnight, that's the longest night. That's one of those nights like in Alaska where it's like you don't see the daylight forever. I remember I was 40 movies into it and a few years ago won like the Fresh Face of the Year award, and I thought, my face ain't that fresh, man. I've just been doing it for a really long time, and I love doing it, and this particular cast is the funniest cast I've ever been a part of, so they make me look good. Mm-hmm. And I would take jobs just to apprentice, you know, take a small role opposite Dustin Hoffman or Morgan Freeman, you know, just to be around these people. And so I feel like I've learned from the best, so maybe I have something to contribute now.
Has the process changed at all for you since you started acting in the film business?
Yeah, I mean, now it's totally different. Guys like you and even me on Twitter, all of us, we all now have a voice.
Right.
And we're putting the power back in the people where you see a movie and you laugh and you say, hey, man, this movie's funny. Word gets out and it's very accessible. Or, you know, the opposite as well. So I think it's the days of, you know, a studio basically shoving a movie down people's throats and telling you to see it because an international box office star is in it, and that's, you know, and then not giving you a choice. I feel like those days are done.
Right.
Yeah. Are you going to go out this weekend and sneak into some theaters and?
I'm not going to sneak. I'm going to make it very obvious. I'll go in there. I mean, I'll go in there and say hello to people, do a Q&A, I'll stalk them, whatever. No, it'll be fun to kind of run around, and I may do it with Adam and with Neil, the director, and I'll be probably in New York. I'll be in Chicago first and then New York, and then maybe go city to city. I don't know. I think it could be really fun, actually, because there's nothing better than with this movie, kind of watching the reaction from people.
Yeah.
Right.
Oh, comedies are really great with a big audience.
Mm-hmm.
It's just infectious. Yeah.
But, it is. I mean, from the first laugh is, you know, rock. Why would anyone want to go climb a rock? Come on, don't be a bitch. And everyone starts laughing. Hey, I'm Charlie Murphy. I fought in the big war. Nobody tells me what to do. Hold this. And then he punches the guy in the face. And people are like, what is going on? You know?
That's what we love, though. Yeah.
Yeah, and then it's like, just buckle up, man. Get, you know? So it's like we basically tell the audience right from the get-go, this is the type of movie it's going to be.
And that's
this
good.
This is what you're in for.
I wanted to go back to speaking of the studio, and you do play one of the, you know, old guards of the establishment, though, in your other great role, Ari Gold in Entourage. And I just wanted to know, you're putting Lloyd through the ringer this time, this season.
Yeah.
You're really throwing him, giving him the hazing that you've been pretty lenient on in previous seasons. But I was just curious, how much of that hazing is, like, improvised from your fraternity days and also from what you've
Not one, it's not improvised. It's all written. I mean,
okay.
It's, It's that's all written in that particular case with Lloyd.
Mm-hmm.
The character is written, and he's given him hell this year.
Right.
And Lloyd's gonna be very interesting to see what happens. I'll go to the creators at times and go, you guys, come on, man. We're in danger of alienating the entire audience on being so cruel to this poor guy.
Right.
Let's figure this thing out. But everything is going to pay off. This season is like no other.
I want a promotion. You do. I've been your guest over 3 years. I've paid my dues. This is about your father?
Do you know that my father was very strict?
No.
Yeah. He berated me and he pushed me and he insulted me. And it made me feel very insecure and lost. But I became a man, my own man, and now I berate and I push. Make your own man, Lloyd.
I'm trying.
Not trying hard enough. The goddamn phone is ringing.
But Ari, we haven't even really talked.
I talked, and my hope is that you listen. Go!
Season is on fire, man.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a great season.
Yeah, and you actually haven't seen anything yet. I mean, it's interesting. I think starting this next episode of Leading Into, you'll see, like, Andrew Klein, who's played by Gary Cole, will start turning my life into a living hell.
Yeah, you mean he hasn't done that already?
Great. No, he really will.
Okay, all right.
He's not going to stop.
Speaking of Entourage, I read a recent interview with you where you said that you had some ideas for an Entourage movie. I was wondering if you'd care to share any of those ideas with us.
Yeah, I can't share too much just because I want them to work, and we're going to see what happens, but that's a long way away. I mean, we're going to go in and do season 7 next year. We got Tony
right
on.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll kind of go from there. But I do think an Entourage movie would be amazing because you would have a chance. I think one of the big quarrels everyone has is, like, why isn't this movie longer? I mean, why isn't this show longer?
Mm-hmm.
So I think people want a couple hours and a chance for the thing to really open up.
Right.
Which would be
yeah
great.
Yeah. Well, we wish you the best of luck with The Goods. This is
yeah,
a hysterical movie. People are going to fall in love with it. And what are you hoping to come from this experience?
Well, I already had it. I mean, it's like carrying a movie that's just genuinely funny with this amazing cast and
mm-hmm
being around such cool people. It just, I would like to do more of it, you know, and continue on this track. People really do need to laugh right now, and that's what we're going to deliver. I think we're going to deliver the goods, no pun intended.
Right.
Or every pun intended.
Can I ask you one quick question from – we have a couple of questions from listeners, but can I get one off before you have to go?
Sure.
We had a question. The Travel Channel documentary that you did.
Yes.
Do you plan on doing any more of those in the future?
Yeah, we actually just sold a show to the Sundance Channel. And so we're going to be taking a trip every week, and we'll be doing that. And I'll probably go to Israel, and we'll send people to Africa and Thailand,
cool,
and it'll be a blast.
Wonderful.
Oh, that's beautiful. That's
mm-hmm
great. All right. Well, know that you have so many fans out there, and
yeah,
and we love you, Jeremy. We
yeah
love your work, and we're cheering you on always. Thank you so much, my friend.
Thank you.
Thank
guys
you
are good for my ego.
Hey, thank you. Thank you for calling in. We appreciate it.
Take care, you
bye
guys.
Bye-bye.
Right, good luck.
Bye.
What happened in Albuquerque?
McDermott was my best friend and the greatest car sale DJ anyone's ever seen. We'd already sold a bunch of cars that weekend, but I wanted to take it over the top. So I thought, hey, let's put a few bucks into it, you know? Get a good crowd in there. We'd airdrop McDermott in, dressed as Abe Lincoln. He would float in and say,
I freed the slaves! Now I'm going to free those cars from the slavery of high prices!
We had a bunch of great lines for him to say.
Hey, just like John Wilkes Booth, our prices are going to sneak up behind you and blow your brains out!
Well, I asked him, he didn't even blink. He just did it.
Thanks, boys, the thrill
after!
Drop them!
See, I was on the ground with Mrs. Tolero. Planned to meet in the back of a Taurus.
That is so good, my husband would get that. Oh, yeah.
She had me pack a bag of sexual accoutrements. Basic shit, you know, rubbers, lube, dildos. Weirder stuff, executioner's mask, French ticklers.
Oh, you're taking away.
The only problem was, I took the wrong bag.
Don gave me the wrong bag!
I can only imagine what was going through McDermott's head as he fell to his death.
Gotta try to get away from this dildo!
The regrets he must have had.
Most people are in this situation, their last flashes before their eyes, and they go through a list of regrets! For the next 45 seconds, I want to go through the list of things I've done right. Number one, full-length back tattoo of the Hawaiian Punch guy.
He had a huge heart, but my God, was he stupid.
Number three, had my wisdom teeth put back into my skull. Oh, Christ, dildo's back. I'm going to get into an aerodynamic tuck and use the dildo to kiss in my balls.
I killed my best friend.
I wish I could stay. I didn't think it would end this way. But I got to tell you, I always knew it would. Falling to my death, Preston Dick Lincoln holding a big purple dildo. This is how I threw it up.
Next thing I know, it's raining dildos.
All right, that's...
It's always raining dildos.
Wasn't that a disco hit back in the 70s?
It may very well have been, yeah.
Yeah. All right, that's... Yes, Will Ferrell is in that. That last clip featured Will Ferrell. And Ed Helms, as Mr. Piven mentioned, and a great... assortment of terrific comic actors. Even Ving Rhames is in it. It's been a great cast.
It, yeah.
A great cast, a great pedigree of talent behind it. So that should be a lot of fun. That opens this Friday. It's called The Goods, Live Hard, Sell Hard, starring Jeremy Piven. And we thank Mr. Piven very much for his time. Entourage is good. This is very good.
It
and
is.
You and I have both followed it from the beginning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's, you know, and it's definitely, I think what he's done is they found this perfect part for Jeremy Piven, and you know, while he was at first not the, you would say, the major star, he is the one who's benefited the most from this show. I mean, they've really centered the whole thing around him, and you actually, I never thought I'd ever live to say this, but you actually care about a Hollywood agent. I mean, you actually care about him. And
well,
they humanized him in such a way that, I'm concerned, you know, his treatment of Lloyd this season, even though he says it will pay off, it is like you are kind of shocked. Wow, he's really putting, he's going to haze the hell out of him.
You know what it is, though? It's it really captures his unique energy.
Oh, it does.
His ferocity. But at the same time, it gives him colors that the other characters, above and beyond the other characters, I feel. That's why he really stands out in the show, because... At one time, he's you know, a cutthroat agent, and the obscenities that come out of his mouth,
and he's a loving father,
and the whole subplot with Lloyd comes about because
and I think you know that comes out. I also just think also you contrast him to the Gary Cole character, and I think this has revealed so much about Ari these last two seasons with the introduction of that character. That you just can't help. I mean, he's the coolest character and the most interesting character, I think, on the show. I mean,
yeah,
just learn something new about him every other episode. It seems I learned something new about Ari.
Yeah, and meanwhile, I mean, he's been rewarded quite a bit for his work in Entourage. I believe three Emmy wins, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Just outstanding work. So Entourage. Comes on at 10:30 p.m. Eastern on HBO every Sunday.
That's right. Right after Hong and True Blood, after all your HBO excitement.
Get it all in there.
Get it all in there. And then coming up in September is Curb Your Enthusiasm, which probably
I know,
to be.
Man.
I can't wait for that.
I am so excited about the return of Curb.
Yes.
It's really the funniest movie on the funniest series on... The history
the mere thought of it just makes me break out, you know. It's just like so. And this season with the Seinfeld reunion, oh my God!
Yeah, there's going to be a big Seinfeld reunion. Of course, Larry David was the creator of Seinfeld, and he assembled the whole cast back together. They're saying that it's kind of an anti-reunion, so I don't know what that means in Larry David terminology.
It can only mean good and insane things.
Yeah. So if you missed any part of Jeremy's interview, you can catch it again on the archive, which will be available after we close the show.
Mm-hmm.
Give it about 20 minutes, or you can download it for free off of iTunes. You can subscribe to our show via iTunes and automatically get each episode downloaded onto your iPod or whatever they're called nowadays.
Whatever device you have, your iPhone, your iPod, whatever device that you have.
And you don't even, a lot of people choose this option. You don't even have to visit our show to enjoy our show page to enjoy the show. There's an option there on that homepage where you can add our player to your website,
mm-hmm.
and you can have it playing right there on your webpage, on your MySpace, what have you.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, quick and easy.
Miracles of technology, yes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. We're all over the place. We're viral.
We are.
We're like a virus.
Yeah, great, great choice of words. We're like a virus.
Yeah. We got a call from an 813 area code, and that's Tampa area. Let me take this call. 813, you're on the air.
Hello.
Okay, 813.
It must have been
for
me.
I'm muting you. That's from my neck of the woods, and now they've hung up. Well, that's
it
always pays to take a caller. It's just amazing, week after week. But we appreciate you. We appreciate you calling in. We enjoyed the sound of your breath.
Yes. No, but we do appreciate. We really do wish that more of you would call in, though.
Yeah. Yeah.
Don't be scared. I've had people tell me, "Oh, I'm too scared to call in." No. Patrick wrote Red Hulk.
That just cracks me up. If you could see me now in my T-shirt and jeans sitting at my computer, you wouldn't be so intimidated. And God knows what you're doing,
Jerry.
We're going
to do this. Well, I'm just wearing T-shirt and shorts. Yeah, imagine we did this like via YouTube. Oh, my God.
Well, we have a webcam option, but I don't know that anyone wants to see me doing this.
I don't think anyone wants to see me. This isn't a horror show. I mean,
even though I am incredibly sexy, I just don't think
you're bringing sexy back, man.
I'm sexy on the radio.
There you go.
That's right. All right, let's get to our next segment. We started this segment actually a while ago, and we retermed it Inside the Classics. We started with McCabe and Mrs. Miller a couple of months back, and then we continued it with Gone with the Wind. And tonight we're going to pay tribute to a very special movie, Last Tango in Paris.
There you go.
Beautiful composition that accompanies that film with Gatto Barbieri. I know I'm probably killing his name, destroying it, but that's, you know, it wouldn't be me if I wasn't doing that. This is a stunning movie, and Jerry, you actually checked it out. And I did
check it out again because I didn't want to make the mistake. You know, we did a tribute show, The Missing, but I never got to watch it again in time. So
right.
I was trying to rectify that mistake every time.
Well, we're gonna share our thoughts when we bring up our first guest who's waiting on the line. But for the uninitiated out there, let me tell you a little bit about the film. Last Tango in Paris follows Paul, played by Marlon Brando, an American living in Paris, who begins an affair with a young Parisian woman named Jean following the suicide of his wife. Paul dictates a series of strict rules to Jean once the affair begins. They are not to know each other's names. They are only to meet in the empty, unfurnished apartment where they initially met, and they are to share no personal information about their lives outside of the cocoon of that apartment. What's left is sex, and lots of it. Jean remains open, curious, and vulnerable in her sexuality, while Paul uses sex as a means of rebellion against the aimless direction of his life and the wife who killed herself so suddenly and without explanation. The only way Paul can feel is by debasing her and himself, making her tell him the awful sexual act she'd perform on a dying pig to prove her devotion to him and in the film's most infamous moment, violating her anally while using butter as a lubricant. You know, I never thought that I'd use that phrase here on the show.
Well, you just did, man.
Or in any situation. Any situation, yeah. Just how controversial was Last Tango in Paris? It was released with an X rating and later classified in C-17 in 1997. Many critics slammed the film as pornography disguised as art. It was banned for nearly 30 years in Chile. In 1976, the Italian Supreme Court judged the film obscene, ordered all copies confiscated and destroyed, sentenced director Bernardo Bertolucci to a four-month prison stay, and revoked his civil rights for 5 years. In fact, the ban on the film wasn't lifted in Italy until 1987. Co-star Maria Schneider claimed that she felt raped by Bertolucci and Brando during the shooting and considers her participation in the film to be one of her true regrets in her life. And Brando, too, felt very violated and swore never to bare his soul so completely for another project. But how brilliant is Last Tango in Paris? 36 years after its initial release, it never loses its power to move, provoke, or to shock. Even after we've been blessed with challenging, boundary-pushing films like Cronenberg's Crash and burdened with juvenile, titillating trash like Basic Instinct and Showgirls. Robert Altman questioned why he dare continue to make movies following a screening of the film, and Pauline Kael, in what is perhaps the most famous and influential movie review in history, said of the film that it had altered the face of an art form. It was Brando's swan song for the breathtaking, completely invested performances for which he had become legendary. And to this date, I don't think any film has been as honest and expressive about sex and how it motivates and defines character. So helping us further examine this landmark film is acclaimed critic Doug Pratt. He is the editor and publisher of the DVD Laserdisc newsletter, which has a worldwide circulation. He's been sourced or featured in periodicals like Time and Newsweek and the New York Times and Rolling Stone, and he's reviewed more than 22,000 films, and that makes me feel like quite a novice.
Yeah. Wow.
You know. Yeah, once you start feeling good about yourself and the number of films that you've seen, just look at Doug Pratt.
Yeah, 22,000 just really puts, crawl back in my cave.
That puts a lot of things in perspective. His books include a large two-volume set titled Doug Pratt's DVD, Movies, Television, Music, Arts, Adult, and More. He's terrific. We welcomed him on for McCabe and Mrs. Miller, and we are very pleased to welcome him back on for our Last Tango tribute. Doug, are you with us?
Oh, yes.
Welcome back.
Thank you so much for joining us again, my friend.
Uh-huh.
Last Tango in Paris. First of all, you've made a list of your 400 favorite movies.
Yeah, yes, I did.
I like this guy, 400. I can narrow it down. To be honest, I could never do 100 or 200, but 400 I can work with.
Well, you narrowed it down from 22,000 to 400. I think that's impressive.
Those are the 400 that stand out. I've been tempted to expand it, but I think everything else would just be in alphabetical order after that.
Right. and McCabe was your top. But
yes,
but looking at your list, another one of my tops, personal tops, is Last Tango. And that was on your list as well. So to start out with, why don't you give me a sense
of... Yeah, well, you know, you kind of got to put it in personal terms. I mean, I first saw the movie, I was 18 years old, I was still in high school, I was living in Seattle, and I drove down on spring break to see it in Los Angeles, because, you know, it was like the spring of 1973, it had just opened up down there, and of course it wasn't... You know, I mean, it opened in L.A. and New York, and it probably didn't get to anywhere else in America for another 6 months or something like that, because in those days, you know, rollouts were very, very slow. But I went and saw it immediately. You know,
yeah.
I mean, it was an 18-hour drive down there. I stayed with some friends. We went to see it, and then a couple of days later, I came back up. So,
Because the buzz on the film.
Yeah, well, that was certainly, you know, the motivating factor. But when I saw it, you know, I mean, it's almost like the sex is irrelevant in some ways. It's kind of like the music is what lingers much longer than the sex does, and the performances.
I can see that. Yeah.
Yeah, and then the other thing was more recently, you know, I don't think anybody ever really feels old unless they're actually ill, but there is a point when you don't feel young anymore, when you recognize that you're no longer young, and for me it was when I suddenly realized that I was older than Brando's character in Last Tango in Paris. You know, it's like all of a sudden he looks like a young guy and not, you know, some old man. So, you know, I kind of have seen the movie from both perspectives now. And, you know, so it has a very personal, you know, it has a lot of personal meanings, but it's just a brilliantly made film.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it's you know, it's a, in some ways it's about the compartmentalization of grief and the you know, the apartments that you see in there are, you know, different parts of the hero's psyche, and he's deliberately, you know, he pushes his mother-in-law into one room, and then you have these other, you know, little demons or old women looking out of other rooms, you know, seeing what's going on. He hustles them back inside of their rooms, and then this grand, you know, upper attic room that's like the libido or what have you is where he meets the girl you know, and but then at the same time, there's also like this parallel story that's her story,
yes.
You know, where she's saying that growing old is a crime, and I think, you know, that she is grieving over the fact that she has to become an adult, and, you know, and she's contemplating marriage and responsibility and all of that, and her, you know, her father is dead, and she, you know, has to accept that, you know, she's no longer a little kid, and so that they're both coping with different forms of grief and trying to deal with it, and then the film is, you know, treating that symbolically as well as dramatically, and I think that's why it's much more than just, you know, the sex film that everybody got all excited about initially, that you know, there's a beautiful artistic underscoring to everything that is
mm-hmm.
what makes it so magnificent.
Well, when I talk about the sex, it's portrayed very honestly. It's not a movie that exists to turn you on.
No, not at all.
It's there to express the state of mind of these characters. And it has been observed, you mentioned the age, it has been observed that she is very childlike, very open, curious, and in the course of the film, particularly with that ending scene, she becomes an adult at that moment, and he ends the end of the movie as a child, almost cuddled in an infant position. You know, I'm not going to give away the ending, but for those that haven't seen it after 36 years and need to catch up.
Yeah, really. I mean, yeah, we're not giving away no spoilers here.
your appreciation of it. So obviously, it has deepened throughout the years.
Yes, you know, I mean, with really good films. You know, the more often you see them, the more details and the more they thematically support themselves, you know, reinforce themselves. And I was noticing, you know, because obviously I too, you know, was just watching it yesterday to get ready for this, and I was struck in like the tango scene, which is the penultimate scene in the film, how the dancers, you know, are very mannequin-like and very mechanical, and yet at the same time they're creating this beautiful, you know, art.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because they're being mechanical and because they're being, you know, mannequin-like, so that there's like this duality here where, you know, you have to go through these rules and these, you know, certain restrictions and that sort of thing in order to achieve something greater, you know, that there has to be rules in society and there has to be rules in relationships and everything else in order to, you know, achieve a greater bond and, you know, something greater than yourself. So.
Yeah, yeah. And in terms of, let's talk a little bit about the creative talents behind the film, starting with Bertolucci. I think he probably lived in the shadow of this film for a long time. And I think he's tried to go back and kind of recapture some of that Last Tango magic with, you know, to a lesser extent, with Stealing Beauty and actually The Dreamers. Which
The Dreamers, I would say.
Really interesting film.
Mm-hmm.
But where do you think this stands in the Bertolucci canon?
Well, it's certainly, I mean, you know, The Conformist was his first big blockbuster from an artistic sense work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, his films before that are all, you know, most of them are very satisfying. But I think the Conformist is the one that really becomes a pantheon film. I think it's my favorite of all of his movies. And then from that perspective, then Last Tango in Paris just kind of becomes like a nice complement to the Conformist, a reinforcement of his artistry and that sort of thing. I think that the fact that Bertolucci, he continued to grow as an artist, and I think when 1900 was flawed, particularly in the second half, but that it was like an extremely ambitious work, and it was also highly very, very sexual, though it got kind of trimmed down for the American release, but it had probably more flagrant direct sexuality than Last Tango does. But then he achieved he achieved his own goal of greatness by winning the Oscar for The Last Emperor, and so so that kind of like achieved it with that, and then he, I think after that, he kind of settled back and started doing more personal works. I admire greatly The Sheltering Sky.
Yes.
I think that one is magnificent, and I also Besieged.
Besieged is good, yeah.
Yeah, it was Besieged. Was very, very good too. But it's funny because even in his really his poorer films, the films that aren't very good, like Luna, there are moments that are just magnificent within them. He's like one of the great filmmakers of all time. Perhaps now that his career is seems to be kind of like on the downswing or towards the end, because I haven't seen him come out with much recently.
The Dreamers,
right? I think Besieged, yeah.
The Dreamers.
I'm sorry, yeah, The Dreamers was after
Besieged. It was like 2003 or 2004. So.
Yeah. He could still come up with something else, but you're getting a better perspective of what the arc of his career was like and stuff. And he's a magnificent filmmaker.
He really is, and I think with The Dreamers, it's worthwhile as a companion piece to Last Tango, because it does mix the sexuality with, strangely, a real love of cinema.
Oh, it is. It's really it's almost a love song to the movies of that period that it takes place. I mean, it's really a beautiful poem, almost, if you will.
And then with Last Tango, you have the subplot with
Jean
Marie Schneider,
and her
fiance, who is a aspiring film director,
right?
And many people find fault with that. They're with the film, and then it cuts to that subplot, and they lose it. What's your take on that?
I think it has kind of a meta effect to it, that it's on the one hand, it's kind of a tribute to the influence that French New Wave filmmaking had on Bertolucci himself. I mean, there's very clear references both to Godard and to Truffaut, within those sequences and stuff. And I was also noticing that, in quite a few of the scenes involving Leo, there's images of film itself. You get the passing train windows of the subway train, or there's always like these barriers and stuff, and so he's moving the camera, shooting through barriers so that it looks like pieces of film flashing by. So I think there's a real, it's not self-referential, but I think it's kind of like standing back and saying that, this is what movies means to me, and this is part of my psyche, and then from there we're going to, investigate the psyche of these characters, and from there we're going to like look at everyone's psyche and what are the dark places in all of our psyches and that sort of thing. And then it's also just reinforcing just simply the beauty of movie making, and that's what thrills me about, and it's always thrilled me about the Leaud sequences, is just this whole thing of the beauty of movie making, of moving the camera around, and of all the silly things that he's saying. I mean, it may all be satirical or a put on, but at the same time, it's very, very true. you know, he wants to like caress Schneider with his camera, which is exactly what Godard does with every single actress he's ever had.
Sure.
And you know, and so you're getting that kind of tribute to it. And so I think it blends into the film very well.
Yeah, and I love the camera work all the way through, obviously, and when they meet in the apartment and the camera kind of acts like a tango. I mean, it's swaying back and forth and scanning the room, the distances between the two of them as they navigate back and forth. But the Truffaut connection, I guess it's also obvious in the casting of the fiancé, right?
Oh yes, yeah, well that's what, yeah, uh-huh.
Because he was made popular from his role in The 400 Blows.
Yeah, well, I mean, you almost, you know, he's almost considered to be like a substitute for Truffaut himself.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and but I think it's like this, you know, it's Truffaut plus Godard. You know, I mean, it's the combination of the two kind of different types of French New Wave and how they came about, and you know, they took very different paths, but you know, Bertolucci is kind of honoring both of them at the same time. And there's a whole point of why it is taking place in Paris. And, you know, the very opening scene where the two of them are walking down the long walk, and it's almost like they're entering Paris. They're going through this tunnel and they're entering Paris together. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so that at the same time, this film is just kind of like this tribute, you know, or it just this infatuation and romance with French movie making and the idea of, you know, and then from there you extend to what Paris has always represented in, you know, the world of literature and the world of art and that sort of thing. And then it's being articulated here within the film, you know, so.
Yeah. Well, it's a melding of European and American. It's almost like a perfect melding of those two styles. Because in the midst of this, you have the most legendary of American actors, Marlon Brando, in your lead. What's your take on where this fits into the Brando canon?
Oh yeah, I think his performance here is just wonderful. I don't know if I could really, you know, rate which performance of his in which movie is, you know, which movie is the best, because, you know, almost all of them have been wonderful, from Streetcar Named Desire up to Don Juan DeMarco. But this, you know, this one, what you were saying earlier about him being exposed and raw and that sort of thing, I think he was really, you know, I mean, he was really, you know, experimenting with his craft here and trying out aspects of just like letting it go and really taking your own psychology and placing it on film. And I think that in someone else's hands, it you know, might have been sillier or it might have fallen flatter. But, you know, the fact that, you know, he was so on top of his game at that moment and still earnest about his game at that moment that, you know, you don't get distracted by, you know, again, by the second, you know, and people are put off by the sex when they hear about it secondhand. But when you're watching the movie, it's all just very natural and very, very real in a lot of ways. And you know, I don't ever think there's a false note in what he's doing, even though it's a very gutsy performance. You know, it's mm-hmm. out there, and he's allowed to take risks. And I think,
yeah,
you know, that Bertolucci and the editing and the cinematography is helping him in that, because they're never really, you know, they never abandon him. They always support him, and he is just like trusting them and letting go with himself and really letting it go. And yeah, maybe he was embarrassed afterwards because of how much he exposed himself, but, you know, for the sake of, you know, future viewers from now until eternity, you know, thank goodness he did, because it's a wonderful experience to see him work his craft.
It's stunning, and we're going to play the entire scene at the end of our next interview. But the scene where he says, where he's talking to his dead wife.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That just shatters me more than any scene I've ever viewed. That's such a moment of complete honesty, and only he could do that in that manner, I think.
Right.
Because I think Roger Ebert was the one that brought it up, that while he's cursing his dead wife, at the same time, you know that he's expressing his love for her in the only way that he knows how at that time.
Yeah, I mean, it's you know, the major turning point in the film, because then after that, then the relationship between them starts to, you know, starts to really fall apart and stuff, and you know, you're heading towards the end of the movie after that. So it's truly the center of the film.
And the Francis Bacon references. The film opens with two portraits of Francis Bacon, a man and a woman, very discombobulated, bloated figures, as you know, Francis Bacon style. How does that speak to those characters, do you think?
Well, it's reinforced, of course, by all those wonderful shots of people through the, you know, through the oblique glass, you know,
yeah,
through the oblique windows and things like that. I, you know, really can't tell you enough about Bacon's own themes to speak to what it's reinforcing within the film, other than, like I say, that, you know, on one level, this movie works on so many different ways and so many different levels, but on one level, it's clearly about an exploration of the psyche, and obviously, you know, Bacon's paintings are that same kind of expression. So that here, you know, you get in the scenes and the drama what you're getting in Bacon's canvases.
That kind of distortion and the figures behind the glass too, that does have the same effect. And there's shots in there that where you see Brando curled on the floor in a odd position,
uh-huh,
where he reflects some of those images of Bacon as well.
Yes.
And I want to ask you about another critic, and it really is just one of those watershed reviews, Pauline Kael's take on Last Tango.
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, she compared it to the reaction to Rites of Spring.
Yeah,
and,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and I think that certainly holds true. Perhaps, you know, the film, you know, I mean, Rites of Spring eventually became a mainstream piece that you hear all the time on
right.
the local classical station, and Last Tango in Paris is now a traditional, semi-foreign film that, you can go and rent at the local Blockbuster if you want. And so, I mean, you know, in some ways, I mean, it certainly threw critics for a loop when it first came out. I don't know if, I mean, Rites of Spring and what Stravinsky was doing signified an entirely new approach to music, and I think that's more of what Godard was doing in his early films. I don't think that this film, you know, set that was the starting point for that kind of movement the way that Rites of Spring was, but
mm-hmm.
It certainly, you know, validated that the possibilities of film were much greater than what people had thought up to that point. French New Wave filmmaking may have been because they're always saying that, you know, there's nothing original in movies anymore. And French New Wave filmmaking may have been the last original thing the movies came up with. And, you know, Bertolucci, you know, in making this film was digesting and expressing everything that he had picked up from
mm-hmm.
the New Wave and learned from the New Wave. And he was kind of like one of the first of the post-New Wave generation of filmmakers to come out and to accept that. So in that sense, you know, the fact that he was legitimizing it and bringing it into the mainstream more so than those films themselves had done, say that in that sense it was like Rites of Spring.
Right. But this review that she wrote, it's probably the most ecstatic review. I mean, I can think of Nashville was a pretty big rave as well. But they even ran the full thing on the 2-page ad for Tango.
I mean, they ran a lot of her reviews in full on ads
yeah.
when she wrote
about Brando. Though, I mean, if you go back and read any of her reviews of Brando's movies, I mean, she, especially for The Godfather, I mean, she loved Brando. I mean, she really loved him.
She recognized great film acting,
yeah.
You know? I mean, there's no two ways around
really,
it, you know?
A couple of years ago, 20 years ago, I remember reading the review for The Godfather, and I just like, you know, and then I read a couple of other of the Brando, and she just really really picked up on something in Brando and just really, I mean, she wasn't the kind of person that would give anyone.
Well, yeah, I don't want to get off on too much of a tangent, but she was a very emotional. I mean, she was a very emotional critic. She she relied on her emotions, and sometimes she would review a movie depending upon how she was feeling at that moment, and so a so-so movie would get a good or a bad review just depending upon what mood she was in. But she relied upon her emotions and used her emotions in her writing, and that's, you know, one of the major hallmarks of her writing, and what baffles everybody about it, because everybody tries to look for, you know, scientific, analysis of what she saw in films and this and that, and she was reacting to them emotionally, which is
right.
How you react to film, you know.
That's,
and,
yeah,
and
she had it right. I mean,
yeah,
I mean,
and of course
right.
she, her magnificent skill was to be able to transfer that, you know, to transfer her emotional responses to the film, to the written page, and then also to reinforce it with a knowledgeable analysis of
right.
the artistry that was at work.
Yeah, and apparently she claimed she never saw the same movie twice. I mean, she wouldn't go back and watch Last Tango. That experience was so embedded in her mind, she didn't want to soil it somehow.
Right.
Yeah, I don't know about that. If I see a movie that I really, really like, of course I'm going to want to go back and re-experience
yeah.
that again and again.
Yeah.
Yeah, me too.
But, you know, but
yeah,
I guess
to make sure I like it, make sure it holds up the
that's
second and third
indulgent,
time.
You know, us indulgent American something or rather. But, yeah, you know, you see something you like, you're just going to keep on doing it until you're stuffed, you know.
Yeah,
yeah,
exactly.
And then you put it aside for a couple months, and then you come back and you start watching it some more, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And with any great movies, as you said, it deepens in meaning over time. You know, when you have more life under your belt, you see new things.
Mm-hmm.
And this movie is definitely like that for me. In terms of the film's legacy and influence, where do you see that?
Well, I think I think that, you know, it's Brando's presence in it is I think probably its primary legacy. You know, because it is one of his major performances, and it's, you know, that's, you know, it in that sense it was innovative, because I don't think there really is another performance that you can really find that's quite like that, that's both as daring and yet as technically accomplished as what he did there. I mean,
yeah.
But then as we were also speaking about, it's one of, you know, Bernardo Bertolucci's major films, and Bernardo Bertolucci is one of the great filmmakers of all time, so...
Mm-hmm.
You know, so this stands high there. And then just as its own, as a piece of art, I mean, the fact that the cinematography is so beautiful, the music is so haunting, and that there are three or four different storylines all mixing together in this that, you know, really makes it enduring. And the other thing, you know, I mean, you know, the history of movies has like this long history of actresses, you know, showing up for one or two movies and then disappearing altogether.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
Maria Schneider was in two great, you know, greatly significant films of the early 70s. You know, I mean, she was in this and she was in The Passenger. And,
yeah.
You know, and, you know, she may have done like nothing else other than that. But because she was in those two movies, I mean, her legacy as one of the, you know, one of the great iconic film actresses of the 20th century, you know, will always be there because of her appearance in just those two films, and the fact that she did, you know, a good job in both of them. I mean, you know, it's a, you know, in a lot of ways it's like a thankless part, because, you know, she's being manipulated by the men in the film, she's being manipulated by the directors outside of the film. I mean, she's there just as the token pretty girl, but at the same time there's, you know, there's depth and meaning to what she's doing, and she's working hard at it, and she's trying to figure out what the hell everybody wants from her, both as her character and as an actress,
right,
and yet
right.
she holds her own. So, you know, I mean, she, you know, she earned her chops, and even though, you know, she disappeared shortly afterwards, I mean, she will remain in the history of film, you know, because of her appearances here.
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, Marlon and Jack, I mean, those are going to be your leading men, the two uh-huh. men, you know, you can't really do much better than that. I mean,
she is very interesting, too, because she's, obviously, she's still around, and I think the last interview she did was a couple of years ago, where she talked about Tango and how it was a great regret in her life, and how her favorite performance is The Passenger.
Uh-huh.
And her claim of kind of trickery on Bertolucci's part, particularly, which he refutes. So it's very interesting to go back and watch the movie and then read these accounts of the shooting of the film. Doug, we appreciate your participation in the show so much. What are some of your other favorite movies that you would like to come on and discuss in the future?
Yeah, I mean, we're going to do the Doug Pratt Presents, basically.
What are the other 398
movies? Yeah,
right,
300. Well, I mean, your focus is on movies from the 70s, right? So
we've gone back to Gone with the Wind.
Yeah, we go back, so just name a movie. Just pick a movie.
Oh, I'd love to do Orpheus or Juliet of the Spirits or Sunrise or 2001. I'd love to do The Garden of the Finzi Contini.
Oh, all these you're right up my alley so far. So
Picnic at Hanging Rock.
Yeah, we just mentioned that earlier.
Eyes
email,
Wide
that
Shut.
One.
You know, I mean, you know,
we've
I
done
mean,
Eyes Wide Shut. Yeah.
Oh, you've done Eyes Wide Shut without me. Oh, I'm heartbroken.
We'll bring you back and we'll do an Eyes Wide Shut.
Picnic and Hanging Rock. I think we should do Picnic and Hanging Rock. That's my vote.
Well, let's make a date. Let's bring you back. Whatever we talk about, I'm sure it'll be exceptional.
Yeah.
But Doug, thank you so much for taking your time out tonight.
Oh, it was my pleasure. It was it's a movie that's worth it.
Thank you so much, Doug. We'll see you soon.
Okay.
All right.
Bye-bye. Okay, that's critic Doug Pratt.
Hello, Jamie.
I'm sorry, I just accidentally muted my line.
Okay, I thought it was the end, you know?
No, see you later, bye.
Bye.
No, you can hear our first conversation with Mr. Pratt on our McCabe and Mrs. Miller tribute.
Mm-hmm.
I'll make that our featured show later tonight, so it'll be on our homepage there. I think that was back in March, maybe?
Oh, I think February. I want to say February.
If March 1st it was.
March 1st, okay.
Yeah, so if I was prepared, I'd know exactly, but I do remember it was March 1st, so... So it's great having him on. Great conversations we have about movies we're all passionate
mm-hmm.
about. That's what I like our show to be about. Okay, we also spoke about Last Tango with biographer Stefan Kanfer. And this is a great conversation here. Stefan Kanfer is an acclaimed author. He's an essayist and a critic. And his unique and stirring insights on a variety of political and cultural topics is never short of invaluable. He's a veteran writer of many of the major periodicals, including Time Magazine, where he served as their first bylined film critic.
Mm-hmm.
And his books include two highly praised biographies on the comic genius Groucho Marx and the revelatory biography titled Somebody, The Reckless Life and Remarkable Career of Marlon Brando, which you can purchase right here on our homepage. And in this conversation, we discussed with Stefan the madness and the genius of Brando and how that all culminated into his unforgettable performance in Last Tango in Paris. And on the other side of this interview, Jerry, you and I will have some closing remarks about the film. And I just want to warn everyone, I'm doing this lately because I want to be as kid-friendly as possible. There is some harsh language because we play some clips from the film on here to give you a sense of what we're discussing. Here's Stefan Kanfer. You've written a fantastic book about Marlon Brando, and I'm wondering, since there are several biographies of him out there, what was your unique take? Why did you feel the need to write it?
I say so in the book. It's always something bothered me about Marlon Brando, who could be so wonderful, but who made so many bad movies en route. He started off extremely well with five really brilliant performances, or indelible ones anyway. And then, marched through the desert with a lot of second-rate movies until he came out with The Godfather and Last Tango. And I realized in investigating him and talking to people like Elaine Stritch, who were in acting school with him, and with his family and other, I realized that he truly was mentally ill all his life. That's the kind of rosebud that I feel that I have uncovered about him, and that given his terrible liabilities and his awful childhood, with alcoholic parents and a brutal father and a very, very embarrassingly alcoholic mother and so on,
mm-hmm.
that it's amazing he got as many good things done as he did. Not that he made bad films, but that he was able to transcend so much in a Hollywood that was collapsing around him. I mean, if I had to do his life all over again, I would have ordered him to go to Italy the way Clint Eastwood did, and learn how to make movies, and then he would have come
yeah.
back and been another kind of star. But it wasn't in him to do that, so he was just a genius on his own
mm-hmm.
acting level.
Do you find that people that brilliant, a lot of them are in some way deeply troubled?
Oh, I think there's no question about it. You know, I've done books on, for example, people like Groucho Marx, who was extremely funny, maybe the funniest man of his era, who you could never find any happiness with a woman, and whose home life was very, very difficult. And Lucille Ball, who, you know, was very sunny and extremely funny in her own way, but who couldn't really find happiness in her marriage, and waited to have kids until she was over 40. And they were really cute and wonderful when they were little, and it was very difficult for her to be a mother later on. So there are always, sure, there are difficulties. I think genius always comes with a price.
Yeah. But isn't, not to be so, like, selfish in regards to them, but isn't it that damage that makes them what they are, their talent, that leaves their genius on us?
Probably so. I mean, there are always happy people, you know, like Wordsworth, William Wordsworth. Mm-hmm. There are, not everybody has to be miserable and pest
true,
their roses against the glass with their matches in the snow. You know, it's
right.
Always have to happen that way. But for the most part, yes, I think people look at the ledger and the rewards are on one side and the price is on the other. And
yeah.
You know, they don't want to see that price, but that's they end up paying for everything.
Yeah, like a troubled, sometimes like a troubled or a manic film production produces, you know, a great classic film, whereas, you know, a film production that has no, you know, how should we say it, nothing happens, nothing bad happens, is bland and forgettable.
Well, you're quite right. Betty Davis once told me that she said she knew when she worked for William Wyler that she would have a nervous breakdown, but that she would also get an Academy Award. She was willing to pay that price. And I think actors are generally, the smart ones are like that. They either will suffer knowing that they'll get something good out of it, or they just can't help themselves. Brando could not help himself. He just
right.
Would suffer.
Well, he's so fascinating, and especially since the attitude he took in the latter part of his life towards his profession that had made him what he was, compared to when he started, I'm wondering where his art came from. What drew him to acting?
Well, he always said that he went from lily pad to lily pad, which was his way of saying I didn't work very hard for it, but of course he did. He was very lucky early on. I think that his early breaks were such that he finally understood that this is the only profession he could ever have. I mean, his father was a salesman. He tried to be an officer in military school, but he couldn't conform to anything.
Mm-hmm.
And because he's in rebellion against his brutal father all of his life, well, who's the father figure on the movie set? It's the director, of course. So
right.
It was always a wrestling match. If you get somebody like Kazan, who was very strong and a con man besides, you could get some really quite wonderful and moving performances like Waterfront. The other directors had a hell of a time with him.
Yeah,
it wasn't
Kazan.
Really. Yeah, Kazan was probably the best director for Brando early on.
The only one who could control him. He was.
Yes, he could control him, and he could control the script, and he also could convince Brando that what he wanted to do was start soft and not yell all the time and not mumble, and you know, and also convinced him finally that, you know, he could do Shakespeare, and when he did Mark Antony and Julius Caesar, you saw an entirely different Brando. It wasn't a mumbler, and it wasn't an actor studio attitude. It really was a man who cared a lot about language.
Right.
But he was terrified about doing theater, so when John Gielgud, who was in that production as Cassius, said, you know, come to England and work with my company, and by the end you'll be doing Hamlet. And God, what that would have been terrific to see Brando doing Hamlet, but he was afraid of going back to the theater where he'd started.
Excuse me, would you be willing to draw, and you might have already done this, draw parallels between his career and Orson Welles, that the genius struck very early?
Well, one understands that, except that Welles really was a protean figure who liked to direct, liked to act, liked to, you know, I think he's like Chaplin, wanted to paint the sets, you know, he wanted to do everything.
Mm-hmm.
It would not be Marlon's idea to put a ceiling in a set, you know, the way Orson Welles said for Citizen Kane, we're going to have ceilings. And nobody's ever had a ceiling before. You just shot the thing on the set.
Right.
It's that sort of thing. I don't think that's where his creation was. I think there was just a lot of wounds that came out. No one had ever seen this before. The other thing that Brando did, no one had done before, and that is to throw away the script, know where you're going, basically, but reach for those words, because he said, if you know the script too well, it's like reading Mary Had a Little Lamb. He wanted to be of the moment. Now you see it all over the place. You see De Niro and Pacino and Dustin Hoffman and many other people doing it, and Gene Hackman and so on. But in those days, when we're talking the early 50s, nobody did that. And
right.
Also, he, you know, when he was in his first movie, it was called The Men. and he played a paraplegic, a veteran, and he went and lived with paraplegics for 3 weeks, and so he wasn't just faking it. He actually slept with these guys. He tried to get into a wheelchair without using his legs, and of course, it's a non-sexual life that this guy leads, though he's very male.
Right.
And he really played it to a point where, even though the movie is hard to see now, I mean, it's, you can't find it much. It's rarely played on television. It's really a powerhouse performance,
yeah,
when you consider it the first one. And also, there's a story I tell in there, which, if you don't mind, I'd like to tell, because it's the other side of Brando, the funny side.
Please.
And that is when he used to go, all the vets, all the paraplegics went to a favorite bar in their wheelchairs, and Marlon insisted on accompanying him in his wheelchair, and they went there. And they were sitting around drinking, and a woman came in, one of those holy rollers came in and said, "Look, I know I can cure you. I can cure you. God wants to cure you. All you have to do is believe." And she went on like this, and Marlon said, "I do believe. I do believe." And he started to struggle out of the wheelchair, you know. And the waiters came. They were so convinced that he was also a paraplegic, they hadn't been told about this, that they were on either side hoping that they could keep his balance. And he got up, and he walked up, and then he started to dance on the bar. The woman ran out screaming. This is the sort of thing he would do. He was a great practical joker.
Yeah. So he started off real strong,
yes,
as you've mentioned, and then he kind of fell into a lot of bad roles throughout the 60s and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously his big comeback was The Godfather, followed by Tango. But The Godfather, to me, obviously a brilliant performance, but it seemed like he put on, and he would never admit to this, he put on a mask of sorts for The Godfather, and he was so emotionally naked in Tango.
You're right, but that's the wondrous part of his talent. I mean, if you see those movies side by side, and of course I have, and I even when I talk about Brando, I use a 5-minute clip of each one, you can't believe it's the same man. I mean, The Godfather is probably in his 80s, we're not certain, it's never specified, but certainly he's an old guy.
Right.
Then you look at the sexy 47-year-old that was made after Last Tango. I mean, here is Paul, really a virile, interesting man, and it's just very hard to believe that one actor could embrace both these things. It's like Mozart writing The Magic Flute and The Requiem. It's just hard to believe that one mind can do that.
Yeah. What drew him to Tango, do you think?
I think he really had something in him that he had to say. He'd always been euphemizing his childhood, never wanting to confront it directly. I mean, he would confront his father directly, even put his father to work on his company called Pennybaker so that he could humiliate the old man. But he had never really talked about his childhood in that way. And this sexual framework, which is, you know, with a, I think, not a very talented young woman that he's working with, really the camera is all on Marlon. It's just
it's his
show. And in it, there's a couple of moments. One moment when he talks about how his father made him milk the cow, even though he was going to a dance, and he would get, you know, a fertilizer, let us say, on his shoes and all that. And a friend later on saw the movie and said, "Marlon, you know, you could have always gone back and changed your shoes or washed yourself." And Brando said, "You don't understand. You have to feel the pain all the way."
I remember one time I was all dressed up to go out and take this girl to a basketball game. And I started to go out, and my father said, "You have to milk the cow." And I asked him, I said, "Would you please milk it for me?" And he said, "No, get your ass out there." I went out and was in a hurry. Didn't have time to change my shoes, and I had cow shit all over my shoes. On the way to the basketball game, it smelled in the car. And I don't know, I can't remember very many good things.
That one?
Yeah, some. It was a farmer, very nice guy. Old guy, very poor, worked real hard. I used to work in the ditch draining land for farming. And he wore overalls and he smoked a clay pipe. And half the time he wouldn't put tobacco in it. And I hated the work. It was hot and dirty and broke my back. And all day long I'd watch his spit, which would run down the pipe stem and hang the bowl of the pipe. And I used to make bets with myself when it was going to fall off, and I always lost. I never saw it fall off. I'd just look around, it would be gone, and then a new one would be there. And then we had a beautiful... My mother taught me to love nature. And I guess that was the most she could do. And we had, in front of our house, we had this big field, meadow. It was a mustard field in the summer, and we had a big black dog named Dutchie. And she used to hunt for rabbits in that field. But she couldn't see them. And so she'd have to leap up in this mustard field, look around very quickly to see where the rabbits were. And it was very beautiful. And she never caught the rabbits.
You have been had.
Oh, really?
I don't want to know anything about your past, baby.
I think I was telling you the truth. Maybe.
And I think that was a very pain-filled performance. It's a powerhouse performance, of course. I think Pauline Kael a little deranged in her praise.
Yeah,
a little deranged in general, but that's why we loved her. But
well, no, she's a very readable woman. I knew her quite well. We were on the National Society of Film Critics together. But when she said, you know, it's like Sacre de Printemps, and movies will never be the same afterward.
Right.
Movies are exactly the same afterward. You
need
Brando to make it work. If there were Brando you could find on every street corner, fine, but that is not the case. It's a very unique performance, and one which, even though it's a confessional and an autobiographical performance, is nonetheless fiction. And so it's a real acting job. It isn't simply a guy saying, this is my life. It's not that simple.
Sure. I do find, though, that it is the most, and I've always said this, the most honest movie about sex. Sex is used in a way in this film where it absolutely 100% represents character.
You're right, and I think that is also the way Brando was, to his discredit. I mean, here's a guy with 11 children, never related to any of them. As you know, one of them died. And his girlfriend said he died of too much living, and a daughter committed suicide, and that son Christian had killed the daughter's lover. It's a really terrible, tragic, awful life, because I think the sexuality was without responsibility. That's all very well in a film. It's not so great over the course of 30 or 40 or 50 years of fathering children and never really finding a woman that was right for him and abandoning them because he was afraid they'd abandon him if he waited too long. That sort of thing, you know. That's the tragedy, but the tragedy played out in Last Tango. It is a tragedy. I mean, not just the end, but the whole idea of this man having an inability to shuck off his childhood. He just can't.
Right.
Can't get rid of it. It's like something that sticks with him, like, you know, the shirt of Nessus, and he just can't get rid of the blood stains.
Now there was... I'm sorry, Jerry, go ahead.
Oh, no, I just want to know, because we're talking about his relationship with directors, what was his relationship with Bertolucci like during the making of this film?
Well, they went back and forth. You know, Maria Schneider always felt that Bertolucci was in love with Marlon. I mean, she's a very malicious woman, but she might have been right there. So it was back and forth. He was not Bertolucci's first choice. He wanted Trintignant, and Trintignant said, I won't appear naked on camera. I'm just not going to do that.
Right.
And then Alain Delon, he wanted him, would have been disastrous, but he wanted Alain Delon, but Delon wanted to produce it. So he said, no. So he finally got a hold of Marlon. I think it wasn't as contentious as some of the directorial battles that he had, but it wasn't exactly a happy set.
Okay.
It was just Bertolucci is a wonderful filmmaker, and he has a great way of giving you that kind of Francis Bacon lighting some of the subtext of horror. And I think, Brando knew he was in the presence of a real talent.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
And the camera work in that film
it's one. I don't know any other film like it. I cannot compare that. That is a film that's sui generis. I really don't know any other film that comes close to its look and its presentation. You know, because Bertolucci did have that wonderful eye.
Yeah, and it's an interesting project in terms of Brando, because it seems that post-Tango, that's when he really gave up. I think, am I correct in thinking that he felt like he gave everything he had and it wasn't worth going through that process?
He said that. He couldn't ever do it again. And I think what happened, it's not a question of giving up. I think what he did was say, okay, it's only money. You know, he was always running down the acting profession. Mm-hmm. And saying there's no such thing as an artistic actor, it's just a racket, you know, all these things that he would do, because I think he always believed he was garbage. I mean, his father said he was garbage, and even when he got recognized and got the money, he never really, really believed that he was an artist, or, and that was not just a put-on, he was like that. So I think what after that, he decided, the hell with it, it's money that counts, and he would make, you know, films like Superman, for example, you know, $1 million.
Yeah,
not very good, and other films that I think generally were done strictly for a paycheck.
Yeah, one film that still hasn't even been released, the Johnny Depp one, The Brave.
Yeah, well, those of us who've seen little outtakes are just as happy as.
Okay, I'll take your word for that. That's not the first time I've heard that, but.
Well, I you know, anything is of historical interest, but you know, if you look over the oeuvre, you know, you look at. Say the first films, The Men,
mm-hmm.
Streetcar Named Desire, Viva Zapata, Julius Caesar, The Wild One, On the Waterfront. I mean, nobody has ever started a career like that. Nobody.
Yeah.
And then there come things like Tea House of the August Moon, which he plays an Asian and should never have done that, you know. So
mm-hmm.
The last of the white guys to play an Asian, that'll never happen again. And
right.
Then there were things that were kind of okay, like The Young Lions, but he and, you know, he was always having problems with Montgomery Clift, because the two of them, like two racehorses.
Well, then, like, that was his competition. That's
yeah. Cool. Yeah, and then, you know, it was said that, you know, Patty Bosworth did a terrific biography of Montgomery Clift, and in the course of it, somebody says his was the longest suicide in Hollywood. And mm-hmm. I think that probably Marlon's was. You know, I think certainly he
mm-hmm.
didn't wind up dead at 47. I think Clift was an old man at 47, the misuse of drugs, and he had been in a horrific automobile accident
mm-hmm.
and all at Elizabeth Taylor's place and all that. So that didn't happen to Marlon, but it was a kind of slow-mo suicide of, you know, things like...
Can I ask you my Holy Grail question then?
Go ahead.
Is it true, and I've heard this before from a lot of people over the decades, but is it true that if James Dean had not died, that would have forced Marlon might not have made those horrible choices, those films in the 60s, and it would have forced him to really stay on his game because he was the ultimate competition at the time.
Well, James Dean worshipped Brando, and Brando was quite jealous because Kazan had this new guy, you know,
right,
and was directing him. And but Dean used to really do the kind of stuff that Hollywood would come with, the torn T-shirt and the jeans, which nobody did in those days, and he really
right.
aped him so much, and he used to call him at night. And Brando would pick up the phone, and he knew who it was, but he would never answer.
Right.
So I think there was a certain professional jealousy there, and probably had Dean lived, Marlon wouldn't have been able to get away with what he said about James Dean. He said he's using my last year's clothes and my last year's talent. And I don't
mm-hmm.
think he would have been able to do that, because Dean really was quite a different kind of performer.
Right.
Younger, and I think would have. Yes, you know, it's like... when the Herald Tribune was around, it made the New York Times a better paper.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not good to have just one
yeah.
horse in the race.
Right, right.
And after Montgomery Clift died, and he was a sensitive, indelible figure on screen.
Right.
And James Dean was killed himself. After that, Marlon, it's true that he was alone, and he needed a goad, and most of the directors weren't strong enough to provide that.
Yeah, we have about excuse me. We have about 3 minutes of
mm-hmm.
recording time left. Where do you think Last Tango stands in his legacy?
I think it stands pretty high in his legacy, because it'll tell us a lot more about an artist than we would otherwise ever have known. I mean, he says things about himself that I, as an outsider, can only guess at. There it is
mm.
in documentary form, although with a powerful aesthetic. around it. I'm not sure that, you know, Pauline said it would really be one of these things changed movies, and I think those are just extravagances that hurt the film rather than helped it. If you see it now, it's, what is it now, 73, 83, 93?
26 years.
36
years.
If you see it now, it's as fresh as the day it was made.
It is.
That's something.
It really is.
Tell
yeah,
me another
last
film
night again
about,
yeah.
You know. I mean, and the others are dated. Waterfront is dated. It's a wonderful movie, but it's dated. And Last Tango is not dated. So I think you can say about it that if it's fresh 36 years later, it's going to be fresh, you know, 96 years later. That film will always be with us. It was misunderstood at first and I think overpraised. Now you can see it for what it is, really a fine piece of work and something that defines an actor at the other side of his career. You look at those first five, six films I was telling you about. To have
okay, I think the interview cut off. Jerry, are you with me? Jerry, are you with me?
Yeah, I'm here. Yeah, I got disconnected too. So.
Yeah, this is the second time we've been disconnected, and the first time we tried calling back in, the clip was still playing, and now it's not. So unfortunately, there's no way that I can play what you've missed without starting the interview over again. But we closed off by discussing the legacy that how the film impacts what lasting impression it has on the Marlon Brando legacy.
Right.
And then we discussed very briefly the scene of him talking to his dead wife, and then we played the clip of that scene. So sadly, we won't be able to put that on, and that's the real highlight of the movie for me.
Right.
But essentially. It was described earlier how this plays into his legacy. After this experience with Bertolucci, he said that he would never allow himself to be so vulnerable again for an artistic endeavor, that it was all foolishness to him. So it
right.
seemed like a real real changing tide for Brando.
Yeah, because he does. I mean, you know, after this film, we do get I don't know. You know, he never, you know, there's a thing, he never, you know, once he played Kurtz, you could say Kurtz never left him. Because if you notice, he displayed that behavior in interviews, especially the Connie Chung interview or the Larry King interview. He was very Kurtz-like. But, no, he was. He did. He spoke in those riddles. And remember, he threatened to punch Connie Chung.
And just like in the jungle, he was surrounded by ants. Remember the conversation he had with Connie Chung about the ants?
Yeah.
He just...
he
was an eccentric, but
he was eccentric. He went. He bought the island. He moved to the island, and he did. He became very much like Kurtz. But you know, it is. He's right. That is the last time he does really go all out for a role.
And what fascinates me about his performance in this, and if you're inclined to study a Brando performance, I mean, this is one of the top ones to watch, because there's such a melding of character and Brando the man.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was Bertolucci's goal with this, was almost, as Mr. Canfer discussed, a documentary about the actor mixed in with the narrative.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember reading that Bertolucci had a conversation with Marlon 20 years ago or something. And he said, you know, I think I got something to the effect of, I got the real Marlon Brando in that movie. And of course, he dismissed that. He said, you think that was the real me? And almost like that clip that we played earlier.
Yeah.
Maybe. He maintained that kind of mystery and that kind of nonchalance about the process in the latter part of his life.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, I agree with that, yeah.
So when you rewatched it recently, Jerry, what were your... What were you immediately thinking?
Well, the first thing that really stood out for me was the music. I had forgotten how beautiful the music was. And, you know, I don't know if it's really, he's still very, you know, he's very handsome, I think, in that movie. I still think
he is
you know, everything that made him when he first came on the scene is evident in that role.
I think it's really like the last time we see the very sexually charged, extremely masculine Marlon Brando. And that's another thing about Brando is his emotional capacity, his capacity for tremendous rage or tenderness.
Mm-hmm.
In the same scene when he's talking to his dead wife.
Yeah.
It's stunning.
Oh, it is. And he made, you know, our guests, both of them mentioned The Young Lions, and I do like him in that. It's a wild movie where he plays the Nazi, the good German, if you will. And that's a crazy role. But the other one that a lot of people don't mention, but I like a lot, is The Fugitive Kind. Have you ever seen that? That's a good one.
Yeah, I haven't seen that.
That's a really good one with Joanne Woodward, and that's great. But yeah, the 60s were like a poisonous period for his career. And then, you know, The Godfather and Last Tango, back-to-back winners.
They're kind of a poisonous period for movies in general, aren't they?
Well, not really. No, you have a lot of great films made during the 60s.
There are always exceptions, but as a decade.
I don't buy that at all.
Do you want to fight, dude?
I don't buy it at all, dude. I mean, you have some of the greatest movies ever made are out during that period. I mean, you have Lawrence of Arabia, Dr. Zhivago. You have the birth of the James Bond movies, the really good ones, the Sean Connery ones. There's a lot of great movies there. Now, you're talking about, like, I mean, yeah, if you look at some of the Best Picture nominees, sure. But I don't buy that generalization, because they used to say that about the 80s, before there was all this nostalgia, like the 80s was a horrible time for movies. Going back and doing these summer specials and everything, that's really not true. There's a lot of great stuff. I mean, there's a lot of great stuff in every decade. There's a lot of bad stuff in every decade. I just think it's a bad generalization.
Okay. Well, I won't make it again. I won't make it again in your presence.
No, I understand what you're saying. I just
think where the industry was in the 60s paved the way for the revolution of the 70s.
The Mark Harris book, sure. If we go on the Mark Harris book on his thesis, I see what he's getting at. I mean, look, Dr. Doolittle. If that's what we're celebrating, we got issues. No,
okay, we're going to try to pick up another phone call real quick.
Okay, sure.
See if they have anything to contribute to the Last Tango discussion.
Hopefully they'll be connected.
518, you're on the line.
Hello.
Hello. 518.
I just wanted to know that there's another legend that's been on my mind ever since his death.
Yes.
George Carlin.
Oh yeah.
And I just want to know, what are you guys' responses of him being attacked by the religious morons called the Westboro Baptist Church people?
What have they said? Now, wait, when did this start? When did this, when did they start attacking him?
On YouTube, right? On YouTube.
Okay, give me a background here. What are they saying about him?
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Well, hold on. Let me just put you guys on speaker and play the thing.
No, that's all right, man.
That's all right. But who is the? I have a feeling I know what the is the Westboro Baptist Church, Phelps.
Go ahead. What's your reaction to whatever he just said? I think he was calling from an old scratchy phonograph record.
Is he still on the line or?
No, I lost his line.
Okay. If they're saying anything bad about George, the hell with him. George was one of the greats. I mean, he broke a lot of barriers, the words that you can't say, and he was just very funny. I miss him dearly, and I actually miss a lot of comics from that time period. And he was great on The Tonight Show. He was great on Saturday Night Live. He was great in some of these movies, but he was like a real comedian.
Right.
I miss him when I'm watching Funny People. How's that for you?
All right. Thank you, caller.
Thank you.
Interesting. So, in closing, I think Doug's still on the line. Let me see if he has any
impressions. Well, he posted the link in the chat room, and I'm going to thank him for that.
Oh, awesome. Let me see if I can bring up his line. The switchboard is crazy now. And it doesn't appear that I can. But in closing, this movie is available everywhere.
Yeah, we know these guys. This is the Phelps. These are the people who go to the funerals of the dead soldiers. And, yeah, this is Fred Phelps. This man is a very bad man. Okay, I know exactly what he's talking about.
Okay, and what's the connection to Last Tango?
I have no idea, but they probably hate Last Tango, I'm sure of it, given the subject matter. But I don't.
You're brilliant. It's brilliant. So Last Tango is available now. You can purchase it here off our homepage. You can purchase the soundtrack, which just got reissued maybe 5-6 years ago. It's breathtaking. And there's a great book on Last Tango from David Thompson. It's one of the BFI Modern Classic series, which I love this series of books.
I love David Thompson. I love his writing. He's
yeah.
Wonderful. I love him. I disagree with everything he says, but he writes it so well. He has a great style. But, I mean, he, though, is a big big godfather of aficionado. I mean, he really loves those films.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's hard not to. And I watch – I mean, I have I had nostalgia for a period of time in movies when I wasn't born yet or I wasn't aware of movies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I go back and I wish I could be a fly in the wall for some of these productions
mm-hmm.
and these moments in time, and thank God we have these films where we can live those characters' lives. And Last Tango has matured so much for me over the years as I've matured. Of course, I was drawn to it because of the controversy.
Right.
I had heard, as everyone had, about the butter scene, and let me tell you about the butter scene. I had an argument with a woman several years ago where I said Last Tango in Paris is one of my favorite films. I said, you play Last Tango up against something like Basic Instinct, and there's no doubt which one is the fraudulent one. But and she said, oh, that's a terrible movie with the butter. You know, and that's the kind of limited thinking that has remained in regards to this film.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, you're right. I mean, yeah, the butter. I mean, it makes me think, where is Mo Butter, by the way? But
Oh, our listener, yeah. Yeah, but you know how that came about, the butter?
How? How did that come about?
That scene was not in the film, and they were...
Jamie? We're getting cut off.